Kirk, I know you were there. I saw your picture right there in Detroit. At the you were one of the studs, I think, on the left side of the Bohem.
Sidney Miller. Oh yeah,
there you are. Oh man, you know, it's one thing to be duped into worshiping Hasatan, the adversary, the son of the sun, through Islam or through Christianity. But I just you just shake your head and say, why would anybody in their right mind do it overtly? But you know, why take drugs? Why drink to excess? Why engage in any of these destructive behaviors?
It beats me. I mean, that's so. I guess if you just want to go jump in the mud, go ahead.
You know, and the positive thing about the covenant, the way that Yahweh set it up, is we really don't care. I mean, whoever the Christians were out there that were trying to preclude it and bar people from it, yeah, thinking they're doing a service to their God. If God didn't want Satan to exist, do you think that he would have
come out long ago? Yeah.
Yeah, that he would have conceived him, that he would have put him in, allowed him into the garden.
He plays a role.
He plays a role. Absolutely plays a role, and it's a really important role. And did Yahweh preclude Chawa from talking with Satan?
Not at all.
Did Yahweh preclude Satan from corrupting his testimony?
No, your free will all the way around.
Correct. So, you know, why would Christians think, well, God would never allow anyone to corrupt his testimony? Well, isn't the first story about, yeah, Satan doing that very thing, and you don't think that God had some influence? So your God must be pretty puny if he wouldn't allow anybody to do what he clearly admits in the first encounter in the garden allowed.
Mm-hmm. He allowed Satan to do it. He allowed the Christians to do it.
Right. When Yahweh is saying that those who belittle my name, make my name for naught, in the third instruction that he cast, that he wrote in stone, will never be forgiven. That is an unforgivable sin to diminish the importance and the value of my name, Yahweh. Doesn't that indicate that if it made the top 10 list, number 3 on the top 10 list?
Yeah, on the first, that, I always think of it as the first tablet. Those are the ones that you better really
pay attention to. So it's on the first tablet. Doesn't that mean that not only would an individual would not be forgiven for demeaning the merits of his name, but that it was such a significant crime that he etched that puppy in stone? I mean, there's a lot of things you could do that are bad. To make the top 10 list and to make the first of the two tablets, I mean, it has to be a pervasive, significant, material problem negating the merits of his name.
Yeah, an ongoing problem. Once you start doing that, then you destroy everything else.
Right.
So that's the significance of it.
Yeah, so here, you know, if Yahweh said that, that means that lots of people did it. And if lots of people did it and will do it and have done it, then God is not keeping them from doing it, is it? He's just saying, when you do it, I'm not going to forgive you. So this, gosh, don't preclude people from making stupid decisions. That's not our purpose. Our purpose is to preclude making a stupid decision ourselves by coming to know what Yahweh revealed in his Torah and prophets.
So that you may have a choice.
Right. And then once you've made that choice, you're part of the family. As part of the family, we're about the business of the family, which is to expose and condemn lies while witnessing to these very truths that we have come to embrace.
Right. Because if there's no voice, then there is no choice there either.
Right. And if you're talking to someone, and you've shared with us that you've talked to quite a few people who just chose to keep on being religious. At any time, did you find somewhere where Yahweh said, that is not enough, Kirk? If somebody chooses to continue to be religious in the face of the truth, you ought to go tackle them. You ought to beat them up. You ought to preclude them from walking. Yeah, you ought to give them a noogie until they say scream uncle. Yeah, I must have missed that part. Maybe you found it.
No, I've you've probably kicked the dust off his shoes quicker than I would.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. God really doesn't care. He cares about his children, and he cares about his covenant, and he cares about his name, and he cares about the seven invitations to meet with him, and he cares about his teaching, and he cares about his prophecy. He cares about a wide range of things.
Mm-hmm.
But he does not care at all about those who have chosen to be misled.
No. That's a hard concept, I think, from people who grew up in a Christian frame, because we were told to go evangelize the world. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, God loves all the little children. Right, yes. And God wants to save everyone.
But he's just not there. He's just not on that same page.
No.
He says, go tell them, and if they don't want you, then move on.
Move on. And thank goodness.
Yeah, it's a horrible... It would be you'd have to hang out with guilt all day long that, oh, God, maybe I said it wrong. Maybe I didn't say it well enough. What's wrong with me? Maybe, you know.
Yeah, well, that's half of it. And the other half of it, you're looking at it from the personal perspective. Yeah. That issue as to whether or not we're doing the job as well as we should. And God is relieving us of any burden, any responsibility. And that makes it so all we now have is the fun part. But beyond that, this is a really short experience. We have 18 years left, and for us it's seven fewer than that. So that's not much time, but eternity is a really long time. So do you want to spend eternity with an idiot that would quote the Lord and have a religion that's wholly and completely integrated with all manner of satanic imagery, and then say, but
I live in that world now.
Yeah, and
the rest of my eternity with it.
Yeah, it is just really really amazing what people will put up with and endure and accept. I guess it explains why so many lies are pervasive. Just a wholesale lack of personal responsibility, of being discerning.
I think you got the nail on the head there. Absolutely.
Yeah. But nonetheless, we're going to talk about things that enable people to make an educated decision. This is a really, as we rejoin Paul's letter to the Galatians, Paul was the most misleading man who ever lived. There is no one in all of human history that Yahweh will be more judgmental of, is more condemning of than Paul. And I say that unequivocally. I mean, I don't have to interpret this. And there's a lot of candidates. I mean, Muhammad's high on the list. Hadrian, very high on the list. Rabbi Akiva, very high on the list.
Maimonides would be
high on the list. But there's only one person in all of human history that Yahweh went to great lengths to explain his character, his purpose, his audience, his timing, his place, and his name to say that he was the plague of death. Not just he was deadly, he was the plague of death. And that's Shaul, the given name of the man who came in his own name, called Paul. And Yosha references him every possible way, including naming him again in this Sermon on the Mount, when he calls them lowly and little, the one who would dissuade people from the Torah.
Or the wolf in sheep clothing. I mean,
the wolf in sheep's clothing, the Benjamite. Wolf in sheep's clothing. And then to have Paul say, yeah, I'm a chameleon. I pretend to be the wolf in sheep's clothing. You're pretending to be what you're not to take advantage of, make the prey easier to kill. And Paul writes, you know, that to the Torahless, I was Torahless. To those who were Torah observant, I pretended, although I was not Torah observant. To the Jew, I was a Jew. And to the Gentile, I was a Gentile. I was all things to all people to take advantage of them. So Paul's even admitted it. So, this is the individual amongst all of the notorious and disgusting characters who have lived throughout time that Yahweh despises the most is the author of half the Christian New Testament. Saint Paul, according to Christians, the Apostle Paul, according to Christians, is the man that God despises most of all. So this is an interesting transition. And you know, one of the things, before I read this, that listeners ought to come to appreciate is that deceivers deceive by giving their lies a semblance of credibility. You know, Barnum of Barnum and Bailey Circus says you can fool some of the people all the time, all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. The idea here is that there has to be, for an illusion to work, for a myth to prevail, there has to be an underpinning of credibility associated with it. But it's but you know, keep in mind that even if you make a counterfeit $100 bill so that 99 out of every 100 strokes are perfect and it just is altered by one of 100 strokes, it's not only worthless, it's illegal.
Right.
And the same thing is true. If you, with Yahweh's testimony, if you have 99 strokes that are the same and one that is off, then the testimony is not only worthless, it's counter to God. And in this case with Paul, it's not 99 to 1, it's 1 to 99. There's one statement that hangs out there to, if people take it out of context, to give this sense of credence to the lie. Like one place, Paul says that the Torah is good and that he is Torah observant. And every place else, he tears down the Torah so that when you tell people, you know, Paul was adverse to the Torah, he said, oh, no, he's not. And they take that one statement out of context. And then when you compare that to him saying that, equating the Torah to a dead husband and say that it's pornography and that it cannot save and that it is, that it enslaves, they can't process that. See, I gave you a quotation that said he liked the Torah, so yeah, I'm not even going to listen to those others. Oh, come on. Reason, folks. So this is the interesting transition we were talking about with Paul. The transition from the very derogatory, but now from the ones currently reputed, presumed, and supposed to be somewhat important based upon some sort of a past, they were actually and continue to be nothing, completely meaningless and totally worthless to me. Of course, he's talking about the disciples, and particularly to Petros, who is Shimon Kephesh, the disciple Peter, who stood up and spoke out against him at this meeting. Now, since Shimon had been a disciple and was the most respected member of Jerusalem's called-out assembly, it infers that Paul had thought that Peter's opinions added nothing to the conversation. In support of this unflattering conclusion, Galatians 2:7 begins with a somewhat contrarian position. This is how the Greek actually reads. I'm going to read it, and you can tell me if it makes any sense. Contrary-wise, on the contrary. Nevertheless, you know, when people put two statements like that, I like nevertheless. I think it's an interesting word choice. But you don't say contrary, nevertheless. It's either contrary or it's nevertheless. You know, this the idea, what he's saying now is this is going to be contrary to what I just said. Now, why would you ever do that? I have no idea. But contrary-wise, nevertheless, having seen and perceived that because I have been believed with the healing message and beneficial messenger of the uncircumcised, inasmuch as Petros of the circumcised.
Okay, who entrusted him?
And who believed him?
And who believed him? Because Acts says that ain't so.
Acts says that. Well, Galatians says it isn't so. Yeah. He says, you know, how could you have departed from the message that I preached to you so quickly. You know, you pretended like you believed it when I was there, and then the moment I left, you were you didn't believe.
But
and the two letters to the Corinthians, same exact approach. They didn't believe him. Both letters to Thessalonica, exact same thing. His letter to Timothy, he tells the world, no one believes me, I'm left alone.
Yeah.
Hmm.
There's no record of any support of him anywhere to the
no.
To the contrary.
No, to the contrary, nevertheless. No, he was not believed. If it wasn't for the fact that his letters, long after his death, were incorporated into Marcion's version of Gnosticism and promoted at great expense and published and distributed to an unaware, ignorant, and irrational culture, long after Paul had proved himself to be a complete fraud, no one would have believed him. I mean,
and it cannot be a healing message of the uncircumcised.
Well, no. So he was the beneficial message of the uncircumcised. Are there any uncircumcised men in heaven?
You cannot get there. You cannot participate in Passover unless
right.
you're circumcised.
Right. Well, so you can't become immortal. And Yahweh in Ezekiel specifically says, one of the things that bothers me more than anything else, maybe the thing that bothers me the most, is this, my people, so Paul was a Yehudim, not actually a Yehudim, he was a Yisraelite from Benjamin, but Benjamin was part of Yahudah.
Right.
Yeah, and it was down there by Yehudah. It's associated with Yehudah. It's a neighboring tribe. That my people have been promoting this myth that there are uncircumcised in heaven. And he says, I'm here to tell you that unless you are circumcised of the flesh and the spirit, you are not getting into heaven. So there is no beneficial message of the uncircumcised. And there is no covenant of the uncircumcised. And the one and only covenant is with the circumcised. It's the sign of the covenant. And if you're a woman, you know, where you don't yourself have to be circumcised, what you have to agree to, even if you're not a mom, even if you don't have sons, you need to agree to the term, which is if you have a son, if you are a mother, that you will circumcise your son on the eighth day. You're agreeing to the condition whether or not you are a mother or have a son, you're agreeing to the condition. It is one of the five conditions of entrance
right.
into the covenant.
But even if you couldn't participate, you can still promote. You
right.
can still teach it. I mean, this is the deal. So.
But I think it's really interesting here that Paul, rather than in this place, say that he was the messenger of faith, of a belief system, to the uncircumcised. He didn't say to the Gentiles in this case. So what he is doing is once again telling us, for all that would listen, that his argument with the disciples against Yahusha, against God himself, is circumcision. If you are a Christian, it's over for you. With this one line from Paul, where he claims that he is the messenger to the uncircumcised. That's it. It's over. Because Yahweh draws a line in the sand and says unequivocally that if you want to be part of his covenant, you will be circumcised. Period. And he's not, does not give you in circumcision the option of a spiritual or metaphoric interpretation.
That's literal.
He says, of the flesh and of the spirit. And, well, the covenant only has five conditions, and it's one of the five. How many signs does the covenant have?
One.
One. What's the one sign of the covenant?
Circumcision.
So if you were to pick something that you were going to be different than God on, and it's the sign of the thing that is most important to him, wouldn't that put you at irreconcilable odds with him?
Yeah, absolutely.
And isn't Paul admitting it right here?
Well, the interesting thing about Paul, when you translate from the earlier stuff, he's not a conspiracy theorist.
No, he's right in your face.
Exactly right. Yeah, I mean, we're rapidly approaching his possession, his demon possession thing.
Right.
Where he just openly says this, this, that, and the other. He's told you he's a liar.
Mm-hmm.
He told you he's on a different side. And
yeah, he actually says I cannot lie, and then he says he's insane.
Yeah, and he says insane. He says, you know, I'm perverted because of and on.
Oh yeah, he tells us in Romans that that he was a sexual pervert, and that the Torah made him a sexual pervert.
So how he became the most quoted man in history is only tells you how horrible we as called people are.
Right. How ignorant we are.
Something like this.
How irrational we are. Because and he's reaffirming.
Yeah,
he's at, and he'll conclude this letter by condemning circumcision. And, you know, there's so many people. My old writing partner Ken, you know, is knows in fact that circumcision is the sign of the covenant. He knows in fact that it's the fifth condition of the covenant. He knows that Yahweh says of the spirit and of the flesh. He knows all of this, and yet he will accept Paul's antagonism towards circumcision because he will somehow substitute baptism for circumcision. Where does Yahweh substitute baptism for circumcision?
He doesn't.
Where does Yosha substitute? Say, you know, that circumcision thing, it is, it's, I had a senior moment when I spoke of circumcision. That's really pretty stupid. It's of the flesh. So let's do away with that and let's go exclusively to baptism.
Well, was Yosha circumcised or not?
I think he was circumcised. Yeah, pretty. Yeah, he was a Torah observant individual, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, is circumcision the presentation of circumcision explained with some of the yods and tittles of the Hebrew language that comprised the Torah?
Absolutely.
And is there any one of those that was annulled?
Not a single one.
I think
Yosha said that too, didn't he?
Yeah, but here, you know. That Paul's not saying that, you know, I'm the messenger to the Gentiles. I'm the messenger to the uncircumcised. I've got the faith of the uncircumcised, which means I'm the religion of those who are eternally estranged from God. But by the way, when Yahweh gives the instructions to Abraham on circumcision, does he say that every male would be circumcised, whether they be a Hebrew or not, even the Gentiles?
Well, you mean in his group?
Yeah, when Yahweh was giving the instructions to Abraham, doesn't he have him circumcise everyone, including the Gentiles?
I think he did everybody in his, everyone that worked for him, everybody that was associated with him, everybody that traveled with him. Yeah.
Right. And what about when Yahweh is describing Pesach, and he's saying there's one, you know, Pesach for everyone, Jew and Gentile, and he's saying that, you know, if you want to participate in it, whether you are a Gentile or a Israelite, you need to be circumcised.
Right. Or you can't participate unless you are.
Right. You're not invited. You're not welcome.
No.
You should not attend.
Yeah. I think he says that, doesn't he? Don't we?
Yeah. Absolutely. So this requires Paul to do away with the Torah, because it's directly contradictory to the Torah, do away with the covenant that Yahweh established in the Torah, and to do away with all of Yahweh's promises relative to the Torah and the covenant, and to replace them with his religious faith.
So there's, back to your original point, there is no way to associate Paul with Yahweh. There's no way to disassociate Paul from Hasatan.
Correct. If you are the messenger to the uncircumcised, you are the messenger to those who are excluded from heaven. So 100% of those who are Pauline Christians are excluded from heaven. There's not a single Christian in heaven. Not one, not ever.
So your friends are no different than mine. They cannot walk away.
I know. They can't walk away from what is obviously a demonic message.
Now, isn't it interesting? Every sermon I've ever heard about this, they have changed the argument because they don't seem, at least I've heard Baptists do this, and I've heard Presbyterians do this, and Pentecostals. They always frame the argument of Paul against Jacob. James is always James versus them. I guess they're afraid to be so open about fighting against Shimon Kephas because everybody likes Peter.
Right.
So they change it to James, and then they whip out their little book where he's saved by works, you know, which is a written thing, and then it's his works versus his faith, and they frame it that way. Nobody will touch this circumcision thing.
Right. And he's not talking about works and salvation through works. What he's talking about is he's talking about actions, you know, acting and engaging. If you don't act and engage in the covenant relationship as the terms and conditions are prescribed, you're not saved.
That's part of it.
Yeah, you're not part of it if you don't act on its conditions and engage in its codicils. You're not part of it. And that's the point that Jacob was making. But the reason we know that this is an argument directly against Shimon Kephas, Peter, is that in Acts, when Paul makes this claim that he was appointed to the Gentiles, and that all of the Gentile realms are his and his exclusively, and that the disciples and no Jew, even though he's Jewish, can witness to the goyim. The goyim are his and his alone, period. And that you disciples, what you've got is those Jews, which Paul hated. I mean, he was a self-loathing Jew. And he hated them because they weren't ignorant. They knew what the Torah said, and they knew what he was saying was in wholesale conflict with it, which means it was irrational to believe that Paul could be speaking for the God who authored the Torah when he is in conflict with every concept that it conveys. And so he was happy to give those dastardly Jews, who he besmirches and condemns in his letter to the Thessalonians and to the Corinthians. But the fact is that Shimon Kephas stood up, according to Luke in Acts, and said, "What are you talking about? That we're limited to only Jews? I mean, did you hear nothing about what happened on Shavuot? That every language that we were empowered to speak was a language of the goyim? Every single language? And that thousands of goyim responded when we were able to communicate the truth about Yosha in their language? And so for you to make this claim means that you are wholly and completely ignorant of what Yosha promised was going to occur and Yahweh delivered upon as we move from the third Moed Mikre to the fourth, from Bokorim firstborn children to Shavuot, the promise of the Shabbat."
Yeah, that refutes it all right there.
It does.
Yeah,
Shimon Kephas stood up and said, "No, you're wrong."
See, if you're an honest debater, you just fold your tent and go home.
You would. Yeah, if you were an honest debater and you were, these facts were brought to your attention, you'd fold your tent and go home.
Either that, or you turn around, you're backed into the corner, you turned around the facts and say, okay, and you change.
Right. So, for example, last night as we were driving home from dinner, we passed Church of the Nazarene that was a mega church. I mean, it was this church complex was larger than most high schools. It was gargantuan.
Tongue talkers church.
Yeah, and so, you know, I pointed out to my wife, it says, you know, that's a cult of personality over there. And what's interesting, not as a cult of personality, the mega churches are all based on the personality of the senior pastor, to have developed that kind of following, this person has education in the Greek text. They know that virtually everything they're saying is untrue. And yet they will claim to be conveying the word of God to ignorant parishioners when they know that every aspect of it, from their Trinity to their cross to Sunday worship to Christmas to Easter, to all of it, is untrue. They're just absolute deceivers. So you're right that if you had an honest debater and you compared Shimon Kephas's testimony in Acts to Paul's testimony here in his first letter, trying to write a rebuttal to the Jerusalem summit, you'd have to give up. You'd have to say, well, since he just previously said that the testimony of the disciples was irrelevant and meaningless to him, and now he's saying that his belief system is for the Gentiles who are uncircumcised, it's over.
Yeah.
It's just over. It's over. Yeah, there's no fixing this. There's no justifying it. Now, what is it with people that just can't recognize when they have when the truth has completely undermined their belief system, that they would continue to cling to now what they know for certain is a lie? No lie is worth clinging to. It's not worth your soul.
No. That's odd, isn't it? If you just sat there and thought about that for a minute, that is unbelievable.
It is. So, as has been the case previously, we cannot blame scribes for the apparent deficiencies. The Greek text reads exactly this way, and every ancient manuscript, including Papyrus 46, which dates to as early as 85 CE, within 35 years of the date of this particular summit, within the lifetime of the people who heard both, was too condemning of Paul. Well, here's the Nestle Allen Greek New Testament 27th edition with the McReynolds English interlinear, the most acclaimed scholarly representation of the text. It presents these same words as follows: "But on the contrary, having seen what I have been trusted, the good message of the uncircumcision, just as Peter of the circumcision." So here is, they've rendered pistos, which at the time that Paul wrote meant, it actually meant to trust and rely. So they're right in that the Greek word for trust and rely at the time of Paul's writings was pistos. However, the way that Paul presents his pistos, he was so influential on the Greek word that the Greek word now is faith. And that's why almost all translations present it as faith and belief. So it's, Paul never provides anything to trust. He never presents the information that's required to rely. And so everything that he says is about believing him and putting your faith in him. And so, not in any evidence or credibility or anything that's the least bit credible. So there are individuals who use words that are so influential, as in the case of Paul, they actually, the meaning of the word, migrates. Now, but he's saying here that he has been trusted the good message of uncircumcision. So, they're inferring that these words include that Paul is saying that the message of uncircumcision, which would be the message of exclusion from the lone path that we can walk to God, to be with him, and the lone sign of the covenant, a message that is without that, that is deprived of that, is good. Well, this is the opposite message of the Torah. It's the opposite message of salvation. Is the opposite message of relationship with God.
There was,
and he's calling it good.
There was no message of uncircumcision. He invents this right here. I mean,
that is correct.
There was no word that said, okay, let's all not be uncircumcised and go to God. I mean, there was no such message. It's total invention.
No, there was no. There was no religion, faith based on uncircumcision. It's true that the Babylonian religion and the Greek religion and the Roman religion did not have as a sign or a condition circumcision. As a matter of fact, the Greeks were opposed to circumcision.
But he implies like this is a thing.
But this is the thing, that there is a thing, and there is no such thing. And so that according to Nestle Allen, it's the good message of uncircumcision, as in there was a religious covenant based on uncircumcision. But Paul's inventing that now.
Yeah.
That didn't exist previously. The good message of the uncircumcised, and just as Peter of the circumcision. You notice that according to the most trusted scholarly source, the uncircumcision message is good, and Peter the circumcision message is not listed as good.
No, it's just
only one of the two is good, and it's uncircumcision is good. Circumcision is associated with Peter, whom he'll condemn.
Yeah.
Therefore, should we believe Paul, Shimon Kephish, Peter, and Paulos, Paul, were engaged in the same mission, but two different people? But if this was the case, why is Paul so condemning of the disciples at the meeting? But by the way, since there are no people called the uncircumcised, no such thing.
No
group of people known as the uncircumcised. So this notion that the Christians have that they were just splitting the turf, Paul took the world with exception of 0.001% of the world's population. Paul got 99.99%. And that. And God never has a different message for Gentiles than for Yehuda. But this, not what the words say. It says that the message to the uncircumcised is good, and it's Paul's, where Peter has the message of circumcision. So what he's differentiating is not people groups, but message.
Now, if Yahweh is supporting both of them, what does that make Yahweh?
disingenuous, confused.
Lying.
Dishonest. Yeah, that's right.
So what, he's in a quandary now.
You can't say that circumcision is the symbol of my covenant for all time and for all people. And then have a good message of uncircumcision. You can't exclude the uncircumcised from heaven and say it's good. Schizophrenic, maybe.